Before we begin, we want to offer a content warning. This episode contains some brief but very sensitive discussions around pregnancy loss, including miscarriage and stillbirth. We recognise how painful and personal these experiences can be, and we understand that this content may be distressing for some listeners. Please take care of yourself. If you feel this topic might be too difficult to hear right now, it's absolutely okay to pause, skip, or even miss this episode entirely. You can always come back to it whenever you're ready, or not at all. We've included some details of support resources at the end of this episode. Thank you for being here. Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us for this important conversation. In veterinary medicine, as in many high responsibility professions, decisions often need to be made quickly, and sometimes with incomplete knowledge and always with the rate of real-world consequences. Mistakes, near misses, and challenging calls are part of the professional landscape, but the way we prepare, adapt, and reflect afterwards is what truly shapes our practice and our well-being. Today, we're joined by voices from both veterinary and human medicine to explore how different disciplines manage error and navigate critical decisions. From the consulting room to the theatre and across the hospital environment, our guests have each faced pivotal moments where outcomes depended on their judgment. We'll hear candid stories of when things haven't gone to plan, insights into training for decision-making under pressure, and honest reflections on how these experiences affect professionals personally as well as clinically. Our aim is to uncover practical lessons that can support vets and vet nurses in everyday practice. And I'm delighted to be joined by veterinary specialist Sylvia Funes and medical colleague Ramsey Funes. Before we begin, I'll ask each of you just to share a little bit about your background and the work that you do. So, Sylvia, welcome. Let's hear a little bit about you.
Hi, I'm an internal medicine specialist. I work in San Francisco, in California. And we work in a really big place. We have pretty much the majority of the specialties right now. We have a very robust and a very good emergency room. And then we have critical care, and I work upstairs and actually on my office right now. And here we have oncology and medicine who work upstairs. And we see a mix of patients. I see my primary cases, but then I have transfers through the emergency service every day. And many times we see referrals from other emergency hospitals. So we tend to get like really sick patients as a transfer to internal medicine. We are very lucky to have a great emergency service. So I think that's why we get many of these sicker patients.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. And Ramsey, let's hear a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you for having me, Gemma. So I'm a pediatrician who specializes in pediatric emergency medicine. I work at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford in the UK. And I'm currently, although I do work in the emergency room, I'm currently doing a split fellowship between pediatric intensive care, pediatric major trauma, and pediatric retrieval medicine, where essentially I spend a lot of my clinical time on the peds ICU and retrieval service. That is going out in a sort of ICU-equipped ambulance to pick up sick kids in smaller hospitals in the region to bring them back to our unit. It's very varied. As you know, most people who work in emergency medicine like variety. I've got a really large variety of patients that I look after, from, you know, toddlers with sniffles, all the way to sort of, you know, teenagers who've jumped off a bridge and have multiple injuries and things. So, that's kind of where I come from. I have done quite a lot of adult emergency medicine in the past, but I'm very much a pediatrician, and that's how I hope to stay.
Absolutely. So I suppose just to kick this session off, we could start by thinking about maybe you guys sharing a moment early on in your career where you realized just how high stakes decisions could be for you in your profession.
Yeah, I can start if you want. I have a patient of mine that I think it's one of these patients that you realize in that moment that your decisions really matter, and that unfortunately not always going to be the right one. So I have this golden retriever. It was a 4-year-old golden that was going for a walk with her, like her owners and the kid. It was a 14-year-old kid who was walking the dog here in the Bay. In the Bay Area, we have like a lot of like oaks and a lot of like trees in the mountain. And she was on Instagram and she didn't realize the dog ate a Amanita mushroom. 24 hours later, the dog got very sick. They came to the hospital. These are patients who doing everything, you still have a huge mortality, over 50% of them. It's an acute hepatic failure. So the dog was hospitalized overnight, diagnosed. It was in a constant red infusion of plasma in every single empty acid. And it was just having this horrific regurgitation. It was regurgitating and regurgitating nonstop. I came at 8 a.m. This was transferred to our department. The dog was very sick and I was starting to get worried. It was going to aspirate because kept regurgitating nonstop. So we did an ultrasound. The stomach was huge. And at that moment I decided, so well, let's decompress the stomach and see if that way the dog stops regurgitating and I can avoid pneumonia. So I went ahead and I was like, well, I definitely cannot send this to surgery. I cannot intubate it because it's so sick. Let's place a nasogastric tube. And when I paid, like I did it myself, where I now feel very thankful because I usually have my interns or my technicians doing this. But I actually did this one myself. And when I placed it in, the dog started bleeding through the nasal turbinates. And you know, you can bleed through the skin and I can stop it. You can bleed through pretty much anywhere else and I can stop it, but I will not stop a bleeding from the nose. I started bleeding and bleeding. And before I knew, I was in the ICU, me and my criticalist. My criticalist, like with a huge bag of blood, like just bolsing blood to this dog. And I was just looking at the dog, like pure in blood through the mouth, through the nose. And actually the dog died from hemorrhage. And I think that was one of the first moments when I realized that, you know, I don't work on emergency, but in that moment you are like, shit, like I literally like, that was it. I mean, was going to die regardless, likely, but was it my action? What it really pushed him over? 100%. The dog died from hemorrhage, from coagulopathy. So I think there are these instances that really shape and teach you something. And that definitely like humbled me very much to realize of like, how high stacks are our decisions every day.
That's such a visceral kind of thing though. When you've got a patient who bleeds in front of you, cause you've got there's such a visual element to it. It's not like, you know, their heart is, you know, they're in heart failure or something internal is going wrong and you've just got some subtle external manifestations. That's quite a sort of shocking kind of thing to be part of. When that happened, were you part of a team and like, how did that affect the team?
Yeah, we were part of the team. It's different in vet med. Usually the top, you will have three vets involved. I think everyone was in shock. My critical care specialist obviously was the only helpful person there who like got a bag of blood and started bolusing the blood while we called the family. We were trying everything, like the epinephrine, put the ice packs in the nose. But at that point, the dog was already in a plasma CRI and coagulopathic. So, I mean, when it started bleeding that much, I was pretty sure that was the day I was losing that dog from that. But yes, like I think not just the fact that the dog died, but the way it was like so dramatic, like so much blood. Of course, the family comes, the daughter is like devastated because she truly feels like she killed the dog, even if she truly didn't. She didn't feed the dog an Amanita mushroom. And it was just a very, like, very visual, very dramatic. We were all absolutely covered in blood. And I'm sure that family still remembers that.
Yeah. Instagram injuries. That's,
Instagram injury. Yeah.
That's a modern day
plague. Like, a few years ago. It was like 7 years ago. It was.
We see that quite a lot in kids these days.
Oh, really?
doing silly things for their phones. So for my kind of example from early on, I think it's a kind of a rite of passage in a way for most, doctors when they're first unleashed on the emergency department, usually, you have a 1-year sort of internship type thing Once you qualify, where you basically don't make any decisions and you're a dog's body on the wards doing various different jobs. And then in your second year, you usually have a general practice or a emergency medicine rotation. Mm-hmm. And that's the first exposure you have to having to make the decision to send someone home. Now you're not on your own. You're always in a team, but I remember like feeling the really heightened levels of anxiety throughout that whole rotation for every patient that I sent home, even though I was convinced, they've just got a cold, or, you know, that chest pain is because they were in the gym yesterday, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And I actually kept a diary of all the patients' hospital numbers, everyone that I saw. I was so paranoid of missing something. And I have to say, even though, you know, I've got a lot of knowledge since then, probably my documentation was best
at that point in my career.
because I was, so paranoid about, you know, not actually writing down, you know, what I was thinking and all the information I got and so forth. But the clinical example I would use is from that year, my second year from out of medical school. I was doing a vascular surgery rotation. Mm-hmm. Vascular surgery there's a lot of death and morbidity that goes on in those kind of jobs. And obviously I wasn't a surgeon. I was a junior dog's body. And one of the things that we were sort of expected to do was when a patient came in with a time critical emergency, like a ruptured aortic aneurysm or something like that, we were expected to do the right imaging, do the right workup, get them prepared and have them on the operating table with the whole team ready for the consultant surgeon to walk in and do the miracle, as it were. I had a chap who was in his late 70s. He was known to have an aneurysm, so it wasn't a hard diagnosis. And he came in with abdominal pain and a saggy blood pressure. And I, even though I was quite junior, I was the person who was tasked with sorting him out. So I sorted him out down in the emergency room in terms of resuscitating him and doing the right scans, getting the theater team all coordinated, had to get an anesthetist and the ODPs and all of that going. And I worked sort of, you know, it was quite stressful, but, you know, I kind of knew what I had to do. And, you know, so the decision making wasn't all that difficult. I got him to the operating theater with quite a lot of, as I felt, heroics at the time. The anesthetist was sweating. Everyone was kind of ready to go. And then, and this was about 11 o'clock at night, and the consultant surgeon kind of walked in his home clothes into the operating theater with the patient on the trolley ready to go. He went and had a look at the scan. Then he went and stood over the patient, didn't say a word to them, looked them up and down, looked at me and said, "Not for theater." And then walked off. And he just left. And, you know, the whole room was like, "Oh my goodness." You know, because this chap was, you know, he was bleeding, and if we stopped resuscitating him, he would die.
Yeah.
But it was a case of the surgeon obviously made this decision based on the information he had that surgery was futile and that the patient would die anyway. And actually he would rather not kill the patient by doing the surgery himself. And so I just remember, even though it wasn't my decision, I remember being totally flabbergasted by how easy it seemed for him. You know, he just sort of walked in, had a look at the information, said very little, just made his decision, and then kind of walked off again and left us to deal with the aftermath. And I kind of thought, I kind of realized I couldn't be a surgeon in that moment, because there's so much unknown there, and you have to be quite certain. And I just wasn't certain. I was like, well, you know, if this guy's got a 5 or 10% chance to survive the surgery, is that not worth trying? You know, it was kind of unfathomable how a human being could make that kind of decision. But the other thing was that decision, it wasn't just about the patient. It was also about everyone in the room, the whole team who'd worked so hard and put this poor chap through so much, essentially intensive care. You know, we put central lines in and all of this.
Yeah.
It had a whole load of risky, you know, medications and procedures on the way to theater. You know, how that sort of, you know, really easy decision sort of really impacted all of us. And, you know, we felt we'd done a lot of things that we shouldn't have done. And so, yeah, I mean, even though that wasn't my own decision, it was kind of, you know, that was something that really kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, to be honest, almost worse that it was not your decision.
Well, thank goodness. Like, I was so junior. Life. Thank goodness it wasn't. Early on in my career with a lot of doctors, it's kind of, you know, it's a really hard thing to make a decision not to do a life-saving intervention and essentially to redirect care down a sort of comfort route rather than trying to. Yeah. Thankfully, that's not something that ever gets put on a doctor in the first few years of their career. So anyway, that was my example.
Both very significant, I think, in shaping your careers. How do you feel that you're trained as a medical clinician to make those kind of decisions? So early on in your career, you're not expected to, but maybe later on, there are cases that come through your door where you do have to make really, really tough decisions like that. And for you, Ramsey, I guess you're doing that in partnership with the caregiver primarily and not the patient in many respects. So I suppose there's things that we can draw across to veterinary medicine where we would be making similar conversations with
there are a lot of parallels actually between, I think, between veterinary medicine and pediatrics.
Especially pediatrics.
A lot of my colleagues like to think what we do is veterinary medicine, not in a derogatory way, but in a kind of, you know, because a lot of our communication is towards the family, and the physiology varies so much between our patients. We have to go quite a lot often on clinical judgment and instinct rather than clinical signs rather than actual numbers. In response to your question, there isn't really a formal kind of part of your training that deals with mm-hmm. that. It comes kind of with experience. And these decisions are, you can't really have a protocol for them. Because they're not one size fits all. The situations are always different. Probably the closest thing we have in pediatrics to a kind of an actual cutoff for when you would offer resuscitation and life-saving treatment and stuff is for late-term pregnancies that are born, you know, at the boundaries of survivability. So that's mm-hmm. 22, 23-week gestation babies. Mm-hmm. Apologies if this is like, you know, obviously this comes with a trigger warning, obviously. In my career, you know, just in the last 15 years or so, you know, when I started in pediatrics, it was like, you don't resuscitate anything under 23 weeks gestation. It's just the burden of suffering that you create by trying to do those heroics in that situation far outweighs any benefit that the patient or family could, you know, the survival rates were less than 10% and 100% of them would have, you know, severe life limiting problems. And in the last 15 years, now that's gone down to 22 weeks. And I know there are some places in the US where there are units that only deal with babies under the gestation of 23 weeks.
Yeah.
It will even go younger than that.
Yeah. Yes.
But, the kind of cutoff that we use in the UK currently is if they're born after 22 weeks gestation and there are some even very subtle signs of life, you do absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. But that's the only kind of like fairly clear cutoff that I think we have in medicine. Other than that, it relies on the judgment of the clinician, the senior clinician who's there. And it comes with experience. You know, I've been unfortunately in the situation a fair amount in the emergency room where I've had to make those decisions for patients who, say have had a cardiac arrest in the community. They've been receiving resuscitation for X number of minutes, 20, 30 minutes, en route, and then they get brought in. And in essentially when they come in, I then have to make a decision. Do we continue or do we stop? And you know, sometimes that's also, you know, extreme premature babies that are born in the community, you know, 21, 22 weeks, and the teams usually bring them in, having been doing everything they possibly could, think of to get them back or to keep them going if there are some subtle signs of life. And then it's a judgment call as to whether this is actually in anyone's benefit to continue or not. You find a lot of, you find this a fair amount particularly in the ICU, where I work at the moment. You know, people do push things sometimes in hindsight a little bit too far, and you get a patient, you know, back essentially, they get some, you know, sustained cardiac output, but their downtime has been so long that their brain doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And then they end up on the ICU for days, weeks, sometimes months, on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. Can't get them off a ventilator. And then the family have this really extensive grieving process where we have to say that this is futile, and eventually have to agree that, well, we don't know what will happen. We have to take the tube out, and if it doesn't work, then we're going to have to say goodbye, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that, yeah, it comes with experience. You have to see a lot of those situations before you get a feel for what is,
yeah,
what is right.
You know, here in VetMed, it's a little different because we have euthanasia. So many of times we choose the end of life. And that comes as a team decision. But the team is you and the family. So I think actually it's a little easier for us in that regard. Like, I don't think we are trained, as I was not trained at all in VetMed about this or making hard conversations or any of that. Actually, here in the US, there is better training, and we can chat about it later. They even hire actors in some of the universities, like in the University of Davis, but I think it's brilliant. But I'm from Spain, and in our vet school, we were not trained for these situations. And it's something that came definitely with experience or when to stop. But we have those little pieces, right? We are able to do euthanasias. So when we don't think it makes sense, you can offer that. That also puts a lot of pressure in the veterinarian, because not every family is the same. Some people really, really are all in, and some other families, they will want to euthanize a dog with a foreign body that could have surgery. So I think it has its pros and cons, and it definitely comes with experience, and always, I think it actually can be trained. I don't think you can train like the same that an ER doctor has worked for 15 years. That's like that experience you cannot give, but you actually can train students and interns specifically to see that, to see how these are group conversations. There is many factors involved. We can't forget in veterinary medicine, the financial factor, like somebody's paying for it directly. And I think our conversations that if you approach them from the beginning with honesty, it can make a huge difference. I see lots of patients with very chronic conditions as an internist. I will have a dog that has diabetes, Cushing's disease, and recurrent pneumonia. And at some point, and I try to actually bring this conversation when the dog is not dying, but is actually doing okay, I usually tell the family, at some point you and I are going to sit in this chair and have to make a hard conversation about end of life. And it's very helpful for you, like that's what I tell them, it's like very helpful for you to go home and decide when are you going to stop. Are you going to stop when he needs to be hospitalized every 3 weeks with DKA, like a complication of diabetes? Like having those boundaries set up in advance, so when the time comes, it doesn't become so soul crushing. And I'm lucky that I can do that in some patients where I can even like schedule like a euthanasia in advance. I think that's like so different from human medicine and gives a very specific, you know, point. But in other cases, we can't, right? When we are in the emergency and it's just like a dog that is like has some major complications, young or something like that. But I do think like in our case, some things can be trained, maybe not to make a decision, but like to come with a plan, like an end of life plan for those patients.
Do you have like formal sort of written advanced care plans?
Nope.
For your patients, I guess. It's kind of, but you've got the scope to work it out with.
Yeah, you have the scope to work it out. We do have when anyone that comes to the hospital, literally, even if they drop the dog here for an endocrine test that is 2 hours, they actually have to sign a resuscitation order, and it can be a DNR, advanced life, or basic life support. But that can like that, I will switch that all the time. Like I will, an example, I will be doing an endoscopy and it's a patient that has advanced life support and I go in and the dog is like full of masses, non-resectable. Many times I will call that family and some of them will be like, actually, please don't wake up my dog. Like just put him to sleep there. So I think they are very, very gray lines. We really like only implement them when the dog like acutely dies under anesthesia or something like that before we reach out the family. And they change. Many times they will say, oh, I want everything, like advanced life support. And then you are doing CPR for 10 minutes with zero chances. And they will say, please stop.
Yeah. I totally agree with your point, though, that those kind of skills, they can be taught, that particularly the sort of generic communication side of it.
Yeah.
You know, we in our training do get quite a lot of simulated breaking bad news things. It's also part of the assessments that all medical students have to have. And then in your training, you're expected to have observed times where you are actually breaking bad news in a real situation and have that observed and assessed and get feedback on it. So there's definitely scope for it. It's, you know, the thing that only really comes from experience is the heat of the moment where you don't have time to plan for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not just an element of how you manage the situation in terms of the communication with the team and with the family or carers, but also there is a clinical decision there of, is this futile? Is this not futile? Yep. And there's often disagreement. So whenever I have to make those kind of decisions in the emergency room, I'm never on my own. I've got a whole team there.
That's usually wonderful.
And it is, you know, we'll be, the first thing we do is carry on. We do carry on through normal life support algorithms that we do, make sure that there's nothing obvious that's reversible. And then whilst it's ongoing, I'll do a kind of a timeout type of thing where we talk as a group and I will say, look, this is what I think is the situation. This would be what I would recommend we do. And that might be to stop or to set a limit on how much longer we would continue. Yeah. And then I would go around the room and say, does anyone have any objections to that? Does anyone else have any other ideas?
Do you feel people are helpful?
Sorry?
Do you feel your colleagues are usually helpful, like objective and helpful?
Yes. I have to say I've not been in the situation where a team member has very vigorously disagreed with what I've suggested. But when you do something like that, if you're a team leader, you do get quite a lot of nonverbal clues.
Yes.
About who is most affected by this, who is not sure, but doesn't actually have any real objection. They're just, you know, it's, you know, you can see the,
yeah, you can see
the reaction to it. And so you can kind of flag up, you know, does a particular person need a bit more time or a bit more input, or do they need enhanced sort of pastoral care afterwards? Kind of situation. The more common objections that I've had is from family.
From family. Yeah. We are similar. We don't have like a team discussion because again, this is like the team, your team is usually you and your family, but we do ask our colleagues. I'm lucky enough that I have lots of like really highly educated specialists around me. And I always tell people, you know, I don't want a proof of friendship. I want you to review this case and tell me if I can do something different because I really need help here. And sometimes like very life-changing advice. I think like stay humble and listen to your colleagues is a huge difference, especially like I have had some patients who are like, there is no way out of this one. And someone's like, oh, we could try this, or we could try testing for insert rare condition here. So I think, you know, teamwork is definitely one of the keys for this. Unfortunately, not always people have a good team. And hopefully there's many factors for that.
Do you often work with the same people? Is your team sort of fairly fixed? So you sort of build long-term relationships with people?
Yes, I work with the same team. So I have my colleague and another internist and we overlap 3 days a week and I love her so much. The criticalist I have worked with, we actually moved together to even a different hospital. I always joke that she's my bonded kitten. And then the ER doctors rotate, but most of them are the same. So at the end of the day, and I have two surgeons who like, I will let him cut my grandmother. So I feel at the end of the day, we are the same team and we have built, trust between us. And I think that's another topic, right? How can you build trust in your team so everyone feels respected, everyone feels heard, and learn how to take feedback in these situations. It can be very tough.
It's great that
you're in your position. But yeah, even for us, it's like, can be very difficult.
Yeah. But it's great if you can have some established relationships with the team when, you know, there's risky situations and high stakes decisions. One of the problems we have in medicine is there's such high turnover of doctors rotating between specialties and between hospitals that more often than not, when you're dealing with an emergency like that, it's a kind of a flash team. We say, you know, where there's a group of people who have literally never laid eyes on each other before, suddenly coming together from different parts of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that, depending on where you work, that can, you know, they have some safety practices in place. So I remember when I was a very junior doctor doing adult medicine, you'd get given a bleep in the morning. Here's the crash bleep. Good luck. And then you'd be kind of like praying all day that it doesn't go off. And when you would go along, it'd be, you know, 5 times out of 10, it would be total chaos. And the other 5 times out of 10, you'd be stood down because it was a false alarm. And, but it always felt really sort of challenging because you'd go there and you don't know who the team leader is. You don't know who anyone's role is. There's not time to do introductions. Nowadays, most places will have a safety huddle at the beginning and end of every shift where the crash team will get together, introduce themselves and make a plan. So, you know, if we have a crash call, are you happy doing the airway? Are you happy doing drugs? You're going to be the team leader, et cetera.
I think that's a great acquisition. We actually, you know, a lot of the things that happen in veterinary medicine are learned from human medicine. And now in our ICU, we actually implement something similar where, there is very this, like, there are roles and everyone knows when the dog comes and needs CPR, everyone knows beginning of the day who is going to intubate, who is going to do chest compressions and who is going to place an IV catheter. And I think that training has really changed our ER services. Like, but it's all learning from human medicine. Like that's such a good point, right? Like getting in the morning and having that standardized and at least you meet them and you know them a little bit. Yes.
Yeah. Do you guys, I presume you have fairly well sort of established algorithms for, you know, sort of advanced life support and things.
You know,
in terms of, you know, your ratios of compressions to breaths and drug doses and intervals and things like that.
Yes, so that's obviously terrible, but usually unless there is a cause that you can switch, CPR in dogs is often non-successful. But yeah, we do have algorithms and then, and a stop point many times, will stop after like, I think it's like 20 minutes is usually what most clinicians feel comfortable with. There's always that emotional case that has something like a hit by car or like hemorrhage or hypoglycemia, something like you can actually change very quick. And those ones I feel we try very, very, very hard.
So much of medicine these days is like highly protocolized. So, you know, we have algorithms for
everything, right?
Every emergency that can happen. Which is really useful. And you get those drilled into you as a medical student and as a junior doctor. And it's only sort of when you're at the end of your training or you've been established consultant for a while that you start to kind of see the woods for the trees and actually hone in on the specific thing that's actually really important in this resuscitation rather than just going through an algorithm. But it's a really useful safety thing. It's a good way to learn. But it's, yeah, there are some pitfalls sometimes, you know, I've definitely been in situations where, you know, you start going down the algorithm and you're like, actually, I'm not sure. Are we on the right algorithm? Are we correct that this is what's going on? And also, you know, are we beyond this algorithm? Is the patient so sick that actually they're off the bottom of the page and we need to do something more dramatic here?
Yeah. Algorithms are great. Yeah, I think algorithms are great and we try to implement more. And I think it reduces a little bit the stress in the clinician at that moment. I do think like what you're saying, sometimes you're like, I think we are really at the bottom of this. I think we are in like a step B. I think we are like in a step like H. But I do think like one of the things that VetMed can learn is to implement more algorithms before it becomes a problem. So a lot of the procedures or like kind of like stops points that we put here is because there was a complication. So that's how things get changed many times in a veterinary hospital. So it would be nice if these things were in place before there was a complication, and that's why we had to change it.
Mm. It just out of interest in that, it's the same thing happens in adult meds and pediatrics. You know, you have a bare minimum of safety procedures for, you know, really high risk things like, you know, you've got an intubation checklist and an extubation checklist, and we do a timeout before any operation called the WHO checklist or the WHO checklist where everyone introduces themselves and all the planning is sort of tick boxed and so forth. But, you know, you can have, there are some places that have similar things for lumbar punctures in babies. And you think, well, you know, that's a routine everyday kind of thing. Why on earth would you have a checklist for it? We let the SHOs or the junior doctors do them independently. Yeah. But it's because some incident has happened at some point, there's been a complaint, and then that's the reaction. So but I want to ask, in your practice, what's the kind of the framework for how those kind of safety incidents things get eventually sort of turned into a protocol or a checklist or something?
Yeah, so they happen.
Or incident reporting or?
We have incident reports. So we do incident reports for anything. And that, you know, it is what makes us then have a protocol that changes. And I have so many examples. It's like not even funny. From, you know, like now every time you get drugs, they need to be labeled, and we have a mistake, one such a silly mistake, right? Like the sticker in the syringe for midazolam had the same color of the sticker for saline, and I have on top of that, it's just like the on top of that, I have a 40 kilo dog. Like, how often do I have a 40 kilo dog that is going under anesthesia? So they drop midazolam, was 3 cc's, put the orange sticker that says midazolam. They also draw saline, put the orange sticker that says saline, and then those syringes were mixed. The 3 cc's of midazolam went into the lockbox of another of my patients. And thinking it was saline, we flush it in, and all of a sudden the other dog was like, all is, you know. So that, after that, we, of course, wrote an incident report. And of course, it's something as basic as we switched the color of the sticker. You know, some of these things are like, they really never a problem until there is an incident like that. And the way we do it, we do incident reports. And we send them to the management office. And then part of the incident report is actually feel as like the clinician and the technicians feel this. What are we going to do next so this doesn't happen? That's actually like a very big part of the incident report. Which steps have you make sure in your team so this doesn't happen? And what can implement as a hospital? So many times that is how incidents are reported and how procedures are checked. Same for now administration of medications. They have to be double checked by another technician always when you draw the line. And to be honest, many times, like even if the doctor puts it, like I want someone to check my math. Like some medications, you do it all the time. So I can like, you know, look at the syringe and I know it's correct, but still we have a double checklist for this because things happen. And mistakes happen, and that's like they can be very shocking, but I also like remembering people, every veterinarian, we are humans. We are 100% going to make mistakes. And likely we make a mistake like every year, like a big one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is it, obviously my sort of medical colleagues in the US live in fear of, you know, being sued and legal ramifications. I presume that's the same for you guys.
Yeah. No, mine is worse. So we, and in the US, and on top of that, I practice in California. We have, everything needs to be extremely documented. The first thing you do is you tell the family that, you know, when they come to the hospital, they have to sign a package of disclaimers that it looks like they are buying a car or something. It is very regulated, and definitely, like, I feel majority of veterinarians I know that they have practiced for over 10 years, they have been sent to the board for a board complaint. And many times it's for a mistake that was not documented. So my take point here is, like, we all make mistakes. Just make sure they are documented and make sure they are passed along to the client. So I think that's, do you see that a lot? Do you have a lot of, like, legal, there's like a legal aspect?
Well, I think we're quite lucky in the NHS in that, that there isn't, I mean, there, obviously, if you make a big mistake or you behave badly, you open stuff up to legal risk. But most doctors who work for the NHS are relatively well protected in a way because you're part of a big institution. The institution has lawyers and a usually quite robust legal department. Yes. Everyone also has to have your own indemnity insurance.
Yeah, so, like us.
Exactly. So you can get independent advice and things. Mm-hmm. And the process by which complaints and serious incidents get, you know, reported and investigated, mm-hmm. Sometimes it's internal to the organization. Sometimes if it's part of a wider pattern, it is an external agency that does it. But particularly in the last, 8 to 10 years or so, the culture is very much kind of, restorative rather than retributive. So it's more about, who suffered and what can we do to make it right and prevent this from happening again, rather than, what rule was broken, who broke it, and how do we punish them, kind of thing. So the culture is
very glad to hear that.
Yeah. So just culture is where it came from.
I love it. And do you feel supported by your colleagues when that happens?
Yes, generally speaking. I mean, in pediatrics, yeah. I mean, we are generally a very, nice bunch of people who support each other and are quite nurturing and so forth. I know that that's not necessarily the culture in a lot of, particularly adult surgical specialties.
I can only imagine.
But you know, it is something that, is quite common in this day and age, particularly in the NHS. And it's certainly they're actually sort of national initiatives. It's obviously a huge bureaucracy. We have a organization called NHS England, which basically looks after a huge number of different things, including safety, aspects of the health service. And, they actually formally brought in just culture, into the formal processes for managing complaints and safety incidents, call it PSIRF, patient safety incident framework or response framework.
Like that. So you have like the team. You know, here, I do specifically in this hospital that I work, feel very supported when we have a medical error. But unfortunately, it's not the case for all the places. And I think sometimes to create that culture in a hospital, you have to invest a little bit, invest as a clinician with your time. So to your team that you also respect them. So the respect become mutual. But unfortunately, sometimes you can be met in some places with a lot of like critique. And it's true, especially during residency, you learn from that critique. But I know, not in my case, I was very lucky to have great mentors. And I think they actually shaped me to be very understanding when someone makes a mistake, like one of my interns now or a student. But unfortunately, in some hospitals, there is this like, I don't want to say bullying, but there's a very, very nitpicky type of approach and these like morbidity or mortality rounds where you kind of like review the case and see what was wrong and you do it publicly. And to be honest, something is very clear what was wrong. Like we have a patient, for example, during my residency that it was having a trepanation to put antifungal and the trepanation with side wave. It went into the brain. Like I don't think there is some mortality, morbidity around there. Like they drill a hole in the brain. So I feel I like the idea that you brought up, like how can like focus this of like who suffer, how can we help them? And obviously maybe individually say what can do next time to prevent it more than the nitpicky of, well, did you check this? Do you have your landmarks right? Obviously my landmarks were not right. So I like that, you know, that difference.
I think, yeah, don't get me wrong. We have morbidity and mortality meetings, monthly. And you know, that there's, you know, in a way you have to be a bit nitpicky and, you know, ask some hard questions to get to the bottom of what went wrong or if anything could have been different. And, you know, so it's tricky because, you know, particularly intensivists, that there's some personalities in intensive care, even pediatric intensive care that are not necessarily all that conducive to, being kind in those moments necessarily. They're quite technical people and they want to get the facts and so forth. So it takes a sort of a culture from the top of making sure that you're always aware of the impacts of, you know, the words you use and how you conduct those kind of meetings. But equally it does take personal resilience from the people who were involved in cases that didn't go so well. You know, you have, if any, questions being asked or any, you know, things coming up as not ideal are going to cause you to spiral into a, you know, a kind of, internal turmoil of feeling like it's good and things, then, you know, that's obviously not anything that the team has any control over. That's kind of a personal thing. So I think in medicine, we do self-select a little bit. You know, a lot of us are pretty, you know, tough in that sense. Particularly the people who get into surgery and intensive care and emergency medicine.
Yeah, too. I think some specialties really draw a very specific personality. And similar, I would say, I think like surgeons are always, you know, the stereotypical surgeon is like a reality in many cases. And different specialties become, you know, criticalists are just so used to death. Specifically in vet med is like so common for them to lose a patient that they do become much more objective. And again, like learning how to work on a team and try to build that trust in the team, I think it is key. And I don't know how many of these things, I think some of them you still can teach them. Some of them you just, you know, with practice, they can.
One of the things that I'm constantly battling with that, balance between trying to learn what happened and how to make things better, but also not offending people and supporting the people. And the rule of thumb that I tend to use is for any of those kind of situations, I always try and think to myself, who are the second victims? Which are, you know, really, I think it's a really powerful concept that I only came across, you know,
I love that.
4 years ago. Yeah, quite late in my training, but something that I think all medical students should probably be taught about. And it's just the idea of, obviously, you know, if a safety incident happens, you know who the primary victim is. It's the patient.
The patient.
The secondary victims are obviously yourself. If you were involved, you know, it's something that will affect you, even if it was you that made the mistake. The whole team, the carers, and any bystanders as well. And, you know, actually having that as a rule of thumb has been really helpful because, you know, there's quite often we get incidents that happen in the emergency room and it may be, you know, someone trying to commit suicide in the waiting room or, someone giving birth in a toilet or, you know,
Like something very
crazy things that happen in the emergency room.
I can't imagine.
You know, and it's very obvious, you know, if you're the senior person having to pick up the pieces from that, who are you going to offer support to, and what time frame and things. It's obvious the person who's at the center of it and the team around, the person, but you often forget people like the paramedics that brought the patient in or the people who are just sitting in the waiting room.
Looking at that. Yeah.
You know, who just witnessed this absolute craziness. And yeah, so the concept of second victims, I think is like super useful and important. Mm-hmm. And also not least because it does, remind yourself, or at least it reminds me that in a way I'm a victim of this as well. I'm generally made of fairly tough stuff and I focus on helping the rest of the team. It gives you a little bit of a pause to say, oh yeah, that was crazy. How did that affect me?
Yeah, that was tough. Yes, I think that's a fantastic approach, to be honest. Like just realizing that in one of these instances, it's not just you, it's all the people around. You know, the always forgotten in veterinary medicine are the technicians. It's not easy to see your patient die as a doctor, but you know what? That technician likely was checking vitals and on top of the dog all day. They are allowed to grieve as much as you for what happened to the patient. And I think we see that a lot. There is, in where I work, like I have a team of technicians and they're incredible. And the same for like downstairs, like our inpatient technicians. And sometimes they are the ones that we also forget in this situation. So I love that concept of like second victims. Love it.
Can I ask you both, if you have a particularly mm-hmm. traumatic incident at work, how do you personally cope with that and process it? You know, if you're feeling the second victim syndrome yourself, or if you've made an error at work and you go home and you're really feeling that emotionally, how do you process it? Who do you reach out for support? And how do you then pick yourself up to go on to the next case or go into the next shift the next day?
We don't have psychologists here in this hospital for us. Where I used to work at Oregon State University was actually, there was one hired for the hospital and it was an incredible resource. I think I try to frame it in like first acceptance of the mistake that it was made, and the impact is definitely going to chase me regardless of what I do. But I try to like focus also in like how many other patients I have helped. Because sometimes you only need just one bad case to ruin your week, but you also likely has helped like 40 other patients to feel much better and give a lot of like help to those teams. So I feel like trying to phrase it like that, it is definitely the best. What do you guys have? Do you have like any sort of like groups?
Well, there's alcohol, which you should not use to say. No. I mean, obviously there's the stereotypes of, you know, particularly A&E doctors drinking and, you know, doing Busting drugs up. And smoking and, you know, being on their fifth divorce and all this kind of stuff. But obviously those are cautionary tales for people that haven't worked out ways of dealing with these kind of things.
Yeah.
I think that there are many different things that I use. It's things like, in the immediacy of it, you've got a team. And if you've, you know, obviously a lot of what I do is in part of a team and, you know, building those relationships and, you know, being able to cry on each other's shoulders and just debrief about things is really important. And anytime there is a sort of something nasty that's happened, in any of the contexts that I work, we always have a hot debrief and that in, you know, within, you know, the first few hours of it happening. And that's not, a sort of, you know, blow by blow, what happened and should we have done this and or that or whatnot. It's literally just saying, how did that feel? Have a cup of tea. How are we feeling in this moment? And, you know, do we need to take some breaks or do we need to you know, go home early or whatever it may be. So those kind of debriefs are really, really vital, and just having, you know, a good relationship with the people you work with is crucial. I'm, you know, in terms of, taking those kind of things home, you know, one of the most comforting things for me, you know, obviously particularly because I work with kids, I'm constantly coming across situations where, you know, in witnessing this horrible thing, you can't help as a parent but feel,
oh yeah,
this could be my child in front of me who, you know, went to a birthday party and cracked their head open on the trampoline or whatever.
Yeah.
And just going home and hugging my kids is actually for me and what I do. In terms of actually discussing or talking a bit about cases and the specifics of what I've experienced, I'm quite selective about what I bring home to talk to my wife about. You know, I definitely do. There are certain things where I kind of like, I have to, because I can't sit with it in my brain. At work, you can talk to people all day if you need to. But there are certain cases I have to tell my wife about just so she knows what's going on in my head. And to have a way of externalizing it. The other thing actually I find really useful is written reflections. There's a lot, big emphasis on in our training, in medicine to do written reflections on things that have happened. And that is, you know, a major tick box for you later on in your career when you're applying for jobs. You have to demonstrate that you are a reflective practitioner. And for me, it's quite therapeutic just writing a little, you know, summary of what happened. It helps me to order my thoughts and provides a record as well. So I can come back to things at a later date and just, you know, reprocess or, you know, interpret current things in terms of what I've experienced before. So that's a really,
That's very similar to journaling, right? But in a more medical way. But yes, yeah. I think that is
in a possibly incriminating portfolio.
Yes.
So you do have to be careful if you do that.
Yeah, yeah, I do think actually that is very helpful. There is an association here in the US called No One More Vet that is like a suicidal crisis hotline and all that stuff. And I think it's absolutely wonderful. I think here, maybe this is where I am, like in California, we have a lot of we talk a lot about mental health resources. And I think that's has make a huge difference. But sometimes you bring it home because I do the same. I rarely talk about work at home. I try very hard not to. But some days I'm just so crushed that I just need to tell someone how crushed I am. But I just still try to leave it at work. And sometimes I kind of even close my eyes and imagine me closing the door, right? Closing the door of Sylvia as a internal medicine doctor today and taking my 10-minute walk home, going for a walk with the dogs and then trying to enter home with trying to shut it down a little bit in that moment, saying okay, this is my time to think about veterinary medicine. This is my time to think about my patient at the end of the world. Now is my time for me. I need that time with me and my family because they deserve that too. But it's definitely something that takes practice. And I love the idea of journaling, even if it's just to put your thoughts out there. And still remembering that some of these cases are going to chase us. Every time I place now an esophagogastric tube, I think about that. I think I'm like, oh, I hope it doesn't bleed. So it's just, there's some things that it shapes you as a clinician and special.
Yeah. One other thing that I have done a few times, which I this may not be for everyone, but I certainly found it very helpful, is if I've been involved in an incident, particularly if it's something where I've made a mistake, I really make sure that rather than, you know, we obviously have investigation framework for how those kind of incidents are looked into. And obviously the person at the center of it is not the person who's going to lead on that, but, usually we'll have to write a witness statement or something like that. But what I found really useful is the few times where I have made a mistake and have reported it and, you know, had to write a witness statement and things, actually taking some initiative on spreading the learning from it yourself.
Oh, yeah.
I found personally really kind of cathartic in a way, but also feeling like something's come out of it. So I've had no qualms about standing up in front of my colleagues and peers, those more junior, more senior than me, and saying, I'm going to tell you about a mistake I made and I want to talk about why. And this is what I've done. Say I've rewritten a guideline or made a checklist, something like that. This is what I think we should do so that myself and no one else has to make this mistake again. And, you know, actually just sort of owning it and
makes huge
change actually personally helps me to deal with that kind of thing.
I'm very similar to that. I'm a very humble person and I really love to actually teach my interns the mistake I have made. So they don't have to do it. A very classic example that I tell them, we teach them how to place esophagostomy tubes, especially for patients that they need a nutritional support. And I always, you know, we shave the area and I saw this like, well, that is the jugular. You don't want to cut through it. It's like, but you know what? I actually have cut through that and it's okay. You just have to call someone to fix that. So I like I have done it. Like I literally cut through a jug once and I saw a huge balloon of blood coming to me. So try to make that error, not to like torture yourself, but also to learn and to like show people that you'd also make mistakes and you also are a person. How can we all learn from the mistakes? And sometimes learning from the mistake that the other clinician make, it actually stops you from making it. So giving yourself a little grace and talking about your own challenges, I think is huge and also builds trust in your team as they see you as like, not just the judge that you is going to judge them, but a human being that also is hunted by the mistakes they have made.
One thing, this may be slightly off topic, but I think it is relevant. One of the sort of traditional issues with incident reporting in medicine is it, you know, before Just Culture came in and that it was a lot of people didn't do it because they felt like they'd be penalized or, you know, that it wasn't, they didn't want to get themselves in trouble or their managers to know about whatever it may be and whatnot. I said the culture seems to have changed in a lot of places. But one of the things that came along with that is, in pediatrics, we call them great X's, which is basically, excellence reporting culture, essentially. So we have two systems, essentially one to report incidents and one to report excellence. So if it just gives a sort of a balance in a way to the idea of reporting something that's happened in the workplace. So it's not all negative. If you work with someone and they've done a really good job at something or they communicated something really well, or you get some good feedback from a service user, you can put that into an excellence report that then goes to the same managers that see the incidents. And it's a formal way of getting feedback for your practice. That's something that came out of pediatrics actually, in the UK.
I think that's fantastic. Something similar. We don't do it now where I work, but I used to love it. You had, I think it was like two chances a year to send to the manager, this very similar, right? Like a body check saying like, hey, I just wanted to thank, I don't know, Jen, one of my techs. I want to thank Jennifer because today we were very busy and she plays that IV catheter in that bulldog that I literally didn't even know it had veins. And then when you will send to the manager's office and what they could do is they will notify the person. And then after 2 points, they will give them a gift card. And it's so small. The investment is so small. It's likely like $300 a year that our hospital manager was spending. But just the fact that you got that email, it really brought you up. Or like, I remember I got one day saying like, we just wanted to thank Dr. Funes who came at 2 a.m. She looked horrible, but she was smiling at the same time that she was pulling. It was like a hook. And you know, it made me very happy to know that I was appreciated by someone.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, it only takes one sort of bad incident to completely ruin your week, or one bad interaction to completely ruin your week.
Yeah.
And obviously that just means that you forget all of the, or you don't necessarily recognize all of the good things that have been happening the whole time, because these are expected of us, you know.
Yes. It is nice to have it as a reminder.
Yeah, exactly. So when you get an incident filed in about you or whatever, or you have to put an incident about something that's happened under your watch, you've also got, you know, the corollary of that, which is all the evidence of the good practice that you've been doing.
Yeah, totally.
Provided by your peers.
Yeah. Love it.
Wow. Well, I think that's a really positive note to wrap the session up on. Thank you both for your openness and for sharing your stories and perspectives. It's been fascinating to hear the similarities and some of the differences between the disciplines, both in the UK and comparing that with the US, but also the medicine to veterinary contrast as well. For everyone listening, our hope is that the discussion reassures you that challenges of practice aren't yours alone, that there are approaches, coping strategies, support systems that can help you and us navigate them effectively. And most importantly, remember that setbacks and tough choices don't diminish our professionalism. What matters most is how we reflect, learn and care for each other afterwards. And I'd just like to finish by thanking you both. So thank you, Sylvia, and thank you, Ramsey, for joining us today. And we hope to see you again soon.
Awesome. You're welcome. Thank you so much, you both.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.
Thank you for being with us for this episode. Talking about baby loss is never easy. And if today's conversation has stirred difficult emotions for you, please know that you're not alone. There is support out there. Here are a few charities that you may find helpful. SANS offers support for anyone affected by the death of a baby, whether through miscarriage, stillbirth, or neonatal loss. You can find them at sans.org.uk or contact their helpline for free confidential support. Tommy's provides information and emotional support for those facing pregnancy complications, miscarriage, or premature birth. Visit tommys.org to access their resources or speak to a midwife through their support line. For those working in the veterinary profession in the UK, VetLife offers 24/7 emotional support, completely confidential and independent. You can call them on 03 03 0402 551 or visit vetlife.org.uk for more information. If you found this discussion valuable, please feel free to share it with others who may also find it helpful. Thank you for listening.